This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is practical advice on how to be happy. Our guest is Dr. Elizabeth Lombardo, a psychologist, physical therapist, and author of the just-released book, A Happy You, Your Ultimate Prescription for Happiness. If you've tried wallpapering your house with happy faces and found that you ended up sticking your tongue at them and throwing darts at the faces, you've come to the right place. Dr. Lombardo is all about very practical things to do to be happy. Dr. Lombardo, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here.
You have a very unique background. How many psychologists are also physical therapists?
I have yet to meet a single one. I have met people who have a degree in physical therapy and a master's in psychology, but never the PhD. So people kind of look at me funny when I tell them that, but then when I explain why, they all shake their head and say, yeah, that makes sense. And it really goes along well with what you practice and preach, which is intricacies between our mind and our body.
You're even more unique than I thought then. You may be one of a kind.
Perhaps.
Well, I'm a big believer that a lot of creativity comes when people cross-pollinate different disciplines, so I'm very excited to talk with you. You gravitated from physical therapy to psychology. What prompted you to make that shift?
Well, I say it all started with a one-legged man. I was working as a physical therapist in a clinic treating people who had had amputations or strokes or spinal cord injuries, anything like that, which was, as you can imagine, an amazing job because I'm teaching these individuals how to walk again. I had one gentleman whose name was David. He came down. He'd had an amputation the day before because of diabetic complications, and he just sat slumped over in his wheelchair and refused to do anything in physical therapy. We had rounds on him the next day, which is when we talk to the doctors and the nurses and talk about each patient, and it was agreed upon that David was having some problems coping with this loss. And it was the next statement that changed my life forever, because the attending physician said he was going to prescribe an antidepressant medication. And most heads were nodding in agreement that that was a good idea, and I just was stunned. I thought, this man lost his leg, and here we are giving him a pill to cope with it. And right then and there, I knew I had to go back to school. I didn't know, thankfully, it would take me 6 years to get my degree. I'm so thankful that I didn't know, and I'm so thankful that I did it. So that's really what changed me. And I went into psychology thinking I want to help people who not just have amputations, but who deal with loss, who deal with disappointment, who deal with whatever life throws at them, and helping them deal with that in the most optimal way.
I would have thought that you would have focused on health psychology, and I get the impression from the book that you've kind of shifted to a focus on happiness, kind of a bigger picture. Is that an accurate take?
Well, about half of my private practice is people who are dealing with physical challenges, a lot of people with chronic pain and what we call medically unexplained pain. A stat that most people don't realize is that 3 out of 4 symptoms that are reported to a primary care physician, so that means when I go into my doc and I say, this is what's wrong, 3 out of 4 of those symptoms are medically unexplained. We have no idea medically why they're happening. So I work a lot with people who are dealing with those types of issues. And the other half are really just people who want to be happier. It's my goal that these concepts that are in A Happy You are taught to our kids, are taught to our adolescents, are taught to our adults. Because if we can all deal with stress better and find more joy and happiness in our life in healthy ways, imagine what our world would be like.
And just as an aside, one of the solutions to the healthcare problem nationally is to get psychologists or therapists in the primary care doc's offices to deal with that 3/4 of the people who don't appear to have a physical cause for their pain or problems.
Exactly, because they're very real problems, they're very real pains, we just don't understand them using a biomedical model. And I've actually worked in primary care physician offices to do just that, and I'm so glad that this is coming to the forefront.
Now, you've probably had clients or patients who said, I want to be happy, I know you are an expert in happiness, but I've got so much physical pain, it just distracts me, how can I be happy?
That's what I call the big butt syndrome. We all have a big butt. We all have a big butt for something. I want to be happy, but. I want to lose weight, but. For when people say that to me, I say, happiness is a choice, which is strange for some people to believe. Happiness is a skill, and it's a skill that if we practice the right parts of the skill, we can get really good at. The problem is in our society, we tend to practice unhelpful skills. And I compare it to this. I'm not a golfer. I don't know how to golf. If you gave me some golf clubs and put me out on a golf course and a bunch of balls, and I spent the day out there, I guarantee you I could develop some really nasty habits. And if I kept practicing those habits, they would get stronger and stronger and worse and worse. And as a society, that tends to be what we do when we're looking for happiness. We think happiness is going to come in a bottle or in spending money or in that the lovely therapists who are so very well known, Ben and Jerry. And we think that's where we're going to find our happiness, and so we keep using those approaches. And yet, even if we get short-term happiness, we don't get that overall joy, that peace and satisfaction in our lives.
So, to some extent, is physical pain a habit?
Well, it is in a lot of ways, cognitively, because when we think about our pain, when we focus on our pain, it grows. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, I'm not saying for people, for example, with chronic pain that it's easy just to say, oh, I'll just pretend like I don't have it. There are a bunch of skills that I work with my clients to, what I say, put the pain on the back burner. So instead of making it the center of your life, it may be a part of your life, but it's not the core of who you are. So that's a big focus in your mind shift that can then change your physical pain and how it feels. Another thing is our behaviors. What happens when we don't feel good, when we have pain? We tend not to move. And my clients often don't move for a while. They don't exercise. They don't move their joints. And then they get sick and tired of it. And they've been beating themselves up. I should be able to do something. I should be doing something. So then they go out and they do what they've always done, whether it's cut the entire grass or clean the entire house or go jogging, even though they hadn't been jogging for a while. And so they go. They use that all or nothing approach. And then what happens? They have a lot more pain. They tell themselves, see, I can't do anything, and they go back to their sedentary lifestyle.
You almost wonder at times if it was kind of intentional in a way that proved their point that they can't do much, so they don't have to try.
I think that's a really important point, is that people who have these medically unexplained symptoms, including chronic pain, there is this sense that people don't believe me. And I have to tell you, I meet so many clients with their arms crossed and the scowl on their face because in their minds, their referring physician has told them to go see a shrink because they're crazy. And so that's a really tough thing. One of the first things I say to these clients is, I know that your pain is real. I know that you are not making this pain up. I also know that stress contributes to pain. People without chronic pain who say, oh, it's such a stressful day. The next sentence is usually, I have a headache, my back is killing me, my neck is killing me. There's a huge relationship between stress and pain. And helping people see that and non-pathologize it, help them see that they're not crazy and that they're not making this up. Having said that, there is a huge mind-body connection. It's really important.
And stress is a term that's socially acceptable, that everybody's going to say, I'm under a lot of stress, whereas there's something mentally wrong with you. That's a tough one to swallow.
Exactly. Exactly. Can't disagree that they're having stress and that they're not as happy as they want to be. And so that's usually what I say to them. I want to help you be happier and have less stress regardless of what's going on in your life. Very few people say no thank you.
So whether it's you doing therapy or whether it's somebody visiting somebody in the hospital who's complaining of pain, the usual approach is to believe their pain, to validate it, and possibly to talk about the stress they're experiencing, how that contributes to the pain, and what we can do to try to lessen some of the stress.
Exactly. And when we're talking about what we can do to lessen some of the stress, there are two main approaches. One is to change the problem, and one is to change your emotional reaction to it. So a lot of times people will come in, if I'm working with people with chronic pain, or let's say I'm working with someone, who has cancer pain. I'm probably not going to be able to change the cancer itself. Having said that, I can change their emotional reaction to it, how they're interpreting that, how they are, their depression, their anxiety, those types of things.
Is a lot of what you do getting people focused on purpose and having something to do with their lives?
Absolutely. That is so, so key. So often we go through life one day at a time. We don't really think about what's our purpose, what are our values. What am I good at? What do I enjoy doing? because there's so much to do. It's almost like we don't have time to do that. And yet the research shows that people who are truly happy are applying their core values. They're using their strengths. They have a sense of purpose in this world, and they're fulfilling that purpose.
I'm still thinking about the one-legged guy. I presume you don't know specifically what happened to him, but now when you confront that kind of situation, what do you do?
Empathy is really important. And with something like that, when someone's dealing with a loss like that, going through the stages of grieving, just like if they're going through the loss of a loved one, and letting them be angry and sad and in denial, and helping them move to acceptance. So not, yay, I'm so glad I lost my leg, but hey, I have one leg that's working, I have one leg that is we're going to get a prosthesis, and I'm going to make the best of it. And this happens in every other situation, too. So, for example, with this financial crunch that's been going on in our society, when people come in, I don't say, hey, I can get all your money back, because I can't. Having said that, I can't help you. What I say, change your brain to get more champagne. Change your brain to get more champagne, because when we change our perspective, when we change our outlook, when we have that sense of purpose, we get champagne. Not alcohol champagne, but the bubble, right? The excitement, the passion, the positive energy to go from that bottom of the glass where you are now to the top of the glass to where you want to be.
And I think what goes wrong with the magazine articles or the smiley faces or the person that greets you overly happy saying, well, smile, is that they haven't gone through that process of really acknowledging the stress or the problems and, if necessary, doing some grieving about it and figuring out what to do now, opposed to just, brace up and smile and get on with your life, kind of a Marine style.
Yeah, and that is such a great, great point, because so often people say, oh, you just want people to think happy thoughts. And that's not it at all. The happy person knows kind of a paradox, which is that happy people are not always happy. Happy people are okay with having sadness and anxiety and some disappointment in their life. They use those emotions, they experience them, they use them to then learn and move on. And when I'm talking with my clients, one of the things I differentiate between is Pollyanna and what I call realistic optimism. So Pollyanna is what you're saying. You know, hey, you lost your leg, no big deal, come on, this is great, sunny out, whatever. You know, those are the kinds of people you have not very nice thoughts about. I'm talking about realistic optimism. And to demonstrate that, if you think of a glass that's half full, we know the proverbial half full, half empty, right? Half full, you're seen as an optimist. Half empty, you're seen as a pessimist. But stop for a minute and think, which is the truth? Which is the absolute reality? Is it half full or is it half empty?
Well, my reality is I want a bigger glass, but
I just want more water in mine. But the truth really is it's both. It's both half full and half empty. So realistic optimism is not denying that half of the glass is not there. It's saying, hey, I'm going to appreciate the half that's there instead of be sad or upset or complain about the half that isn't there. And that is realistic optimism.
In your book, A Happy You, you cite a lot of examples of people who have overcome adversity to become happy people, Christopher Reeves, for example. How do you make sure that their example isn't like that happy face of, well, they can do it, just follow their example? How do you set that up so that people don't feel it's an unrealistic standard?
I think you have to look at your own mind and where you are. And there's something in psychology called the stages of change, which is where you are in terms of your readiness to change. And that can be change in behaviors like quitting smoking or losing weight, or it could be changes in your mind, your perspective. And so for some people, they're in what we call the pre-contemplative. They're not ready to change. People who are depressed and just feel miserable, they're not ready to be smiling and be happy. So you want to approach it in different ways. And in that situation, for example, if someone's saying, well, that's fine, all those people in your book, you know, they had it easier than I do. What I would then say is, ask yourself a question. Given the cards that you've been dealt, and they may not be great cards, given the cards you've been dealt, how do you want to be able to feel? What do you wish you could have more of in your life? And if it were possible somehow to actually have happiness, regardless of what is going on in your life, is that something that you might be interested in? And so trying to see it from that angle.
And by the way, if people wonder what cognitive behavioral therapy is, that's a good example of it. One of the places that people get stuck is with forgiveness. What do you do to help people get past that?
I think one of the biggest barriers to forgiveness is understanding what it is and what it is not. So forgiveness is actually something that you do for yourself. It is a gift to yourself. It is not a gift for the person who has offended you or has done wrong to you. Forgiveness is not saying that you agree with what happened. It's not saying you're going to forget what happened, because forgiveness and forgetting are completely different. Forgiveness is releasing the resentment and the anger and the anguish that you are carrying around because of that event. And it truly is one of the most powerful things that we can do for our own happiness as well as our own physical health. Because the research shows that people who are resentful and carrying a grudge, their immune system isn't working as well. They tend to be more likely to have things like chronic pain and medically unexplained symptoms.
And I suspect the most frequent but you get is in the lines of, but I need to punish them, or I can't let them off the hook, that somehow this gets back at them by holding the grudge.
Right. And that's a great example of when we have automatic thoughts, but when we look at them, they really don't make that much sense, right? Because you being miserable and being angry and resentful and having you can't sleep at night and you're overeating to compensate for the stress that you're experiencing because of the resentment, and you're short-tempered with your loved ones because you're so angry, who's hurting? Who's hurting the most? It's you and your loved ones. It's not the person who offended you. And yet what happens is we still give them the power to be controlling our lives. And again, forgiveness is such a mind perspective change. There's also a belief that I can't forgive this person because what he did or what she did is so awful and unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
And all the forgiveness experts agree that no act is too horrible to forgive. Because again, when you think about what forgiveness is, you're not condoning the act, you're not agreeing with what happened, you're not forgetting it, you're simply releasing the resentment and anger that you're having towards it.
And the not forgetting it is a key part too, because you do need to know who raped you or who mugged you or who stole your retirement money so you minimize the chances of that happening again. But just remembering what happens doesn't mean that you have to hold a resentment about it.
That's exactly it. We want to learn from what happened. And a great example is when I'm working with women who have been physically abused by their partners. I help them forgive. Having said that, I don't recommend that they go back and live with that person.
Mm-hmm.
So they can forgive, they can release that resentment and anger and move on with their lives. And an important part of forgiveness, too, is so often when someone wrongs us, we tend to blame ourselves, too. We tend to blame ourselves. So, for example, when I'm working with women who have been raped, so often there's this underlying, they know that they didn't cause it on one level, and yet there's this underlying guilt that they feel. I shouldn't have walked down that alley. I shouldn't have been at that party. I shouldn't have worn a miniskirt. And they tend to put some of the blame, if not a lot of the blame, on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're forgiving someone, you really want to look at how you're viewing yourself, because forgiving yourself, again, is such an unbelievably powerful gift to really transform your life and your relationships and your physical health and your mental health.
It's so complex. And I think one other aspect of it is if you can put yourself in the perpetrator's shoes and understand how they might have turned out that way, how they might have ended up doing something like that. It's not at all condoning it, but it starts making sense, and you understand that, gee, if I had had that person's life, I might have ended up with some of the same choices as well.
Exactly. Empathy is very key. It's very key. Not to say that we're always going to understand why someone would do these horrific things, but it can definitely change your perspective and help with that healing process. On my website, ahappyyou.com, I have a couple of free worksheets that talk about forgiveness, if people are interested in that. There's one that's called Breathe, and it's specific steps that people can take to go through the forgiveness process. So I'd just like to offer your listeners that. It's a free resource.
Wonderful. You have 26 chapters, 26 different things to do. When somebody comes to you and says, Dr. Lombardo, I want to be happier, where do I start? Do you go through some kind of a process of figuring out what's the priority and the starting point?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the book is designed, it's an A to Z, just kind of a cute way to try to get some information out there. So each chapter is a different letter, and each letter is something else you can do to enhance your happiness. There are certainly themes. One step that I recommend everybody do is to figure out what your values are and what your core strengths are. Because, again, we all have certain values that we may not even realize it, but they are so important to us. And so going through a values checklist, again, I have a free one on my website, ahappyyou.com, and just looking at which one of these are most important to me. So is it family? Is it health? Is it happiness? Is it loyalty? And looking at those values, figuring out your five most important values to you, and then start figuring out how you can apply those values in your life. So, for example, I was working with a client the other day, and humor was a really big one for him. He really just, that just was a core value for him and a strength for him. So we figured out ways that he could incorporate some of his humor into his everyday life. He didn't have to change his job. He didn't have to quit what he was doing and become a stand-up comedian. We can apply these values in little ways that aren't going to take a lot of time, but just putting them more into our lives is going to change how we feel about ourselves.
I think that's an excellent approach, and one that a therapist can be very helpful with, but a lot of people can figure out on their own and take a book like A Happy You and run with it. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Lombardo, author of A Happy You, Your Ultimate Prescription for Happiness. She's both a psychologist and physical therapist and practices in the greater Pittsburgh area. You're also a professional speaker. And the website, again, was A Happy You, you spelled the old-fashioned way, YOU.com. And as you said, it has happiness tips and breathing tips and sign up for a blog and a lot of goodies there.
All kinds of freebies to help you be happier.
We've got a ton of books on happiness. People talk about finding happiness. We've got Stumbling on Happiness. Your emphasis is that it's a skill. How do you get people to make the shift to thinking of it as a skill and, gee, my schedule's already so full, I don't have time to do one more exercise?
A lot of the things that I'm talking about in this book are things that you don't need any extra time to do. So if anyone out there ever commutes, whether it's driving to work or driving to the store or driving to school or walking or riding your bike, you can start to think, for example, about your gratitude. One of the chapter A is appreciation, and we know that one of the best things that we can do to enhance our happiness is to start looking at that half-full glass, start seeing what is out there in my life already that I'm not appreciating. And so scanning the environment, thinking about your life, what you appreciate, who you appreciate, and just starting to look at your life in that way can change your perspective completely. And again, that doesn't take any extra time. Even if you're sitting in the dentist's office or you're waiting for the doctor, these are things that you can be doing anywhere, in the shower, when you're going to bed.
Yeah, one of my mottos, and I teach to my kids too, is always take a book with you. You never know when you'll have downtime. Likewise, all of this downtime when you're standing in line at the post office or whatever is time that you could be doing these exercises and helping yourself be happier.
Exactly, and it's almost like putting on a different lens prescription. So if you think of glasses, and a lot of times we tend to see the world in negative views. We tend to see what's wrong, what are our kids doing wrong, what's our spouse doing wrong, what are our clients doing wrong, and how can we fix it? What can I tell them that they need to do? And yet, this is a different paradigm, which is look at what's good out there. What are your kids doing that's great? What are you doing that's terrific? What's your spouse doing, your friends doing, your neighbor, nature, and just starting to see a completely different perspective on life. It sounds so simple, and yet I guarantee you, if you start doing this, if you write down at least three things that you appreciate and feel grateful for each and every day, within a couple of weeks, I guarantee you, your happiness is going to be changing.
I have engineers tell me their job is to find things that are wrong and try to fix them. But what you're describing is to look for things to reinforce and to look for ways to give compliments, because that's what's going to increase what we pay attention to and what we reinforce and compliment.
Exactly, because when we're looking for the positive, we're going to see it. And what you just said, which is when we reinforce someone for doing something, when we thank them, when we appreciate them openly, what happens? They're a lot more likely to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And as parents, we probably have heard that reinforcement is better at punishment in terms of changing our children's behavior. It works for adults, too. Think about it. If you maybe are someone who tends to go a little over the speed limit while you're on the highway, well, you might get a ticket, you might not. But what if the policy was that if a police officer saw you going the right speed limit, he would pull you over and give you money? Give you that $100. Don't you think we'd all be a lot more likely to maintain the speed limit? Reinforcement. So the same thing happens when our loved ones. When I'm working with couples, for example, one of the first homework assignments I give them is to each day write down at least one thing that you appreciate in your spouse. And start to look at that and start to share that with them, because so often, especially with spouses who are not getting along, there's this a lot of arguing, a lot of pointing out what the other person is doing that's wrong. And when you start to look at the positive, people feel differently. They want to do it more. They're more likely to want to do things for you.
You talk about journaling. What do you personally journal on?
Well, there's three types of journaling. So there's journaling on what we're talking about, the positive events. There's journaling on keeping track of what your goal is. So, for example, if my goal is to lose 20 pounds in, 6 months, then writing down my exercise, my eating, that kind of thing. And then there's also journaling of a specific negative event. And there have been some really neat research studies by a gentleman named Dr. Jamie Pennebaker, who I've had the pleasure of studying with briefly when I was in school. And what he asked people to do is to write about your deepest, darkest secret or the most traumatic event you've ever had. Whether you've talked about it or not, it doesn't matter. You write it down on a piece of paper for about 20 to 30 minutes, 2 to 3 times. That's it. That's it. And when they ask college students to do this, and these are college students who were not coming to the clinic for any problems, just regular college students, when they ask the college students to do this 3 times for 20 minutes at the beginning of the semester, they paralleled them with college students who just wrote about their day, what they'd eaten, what they were doing, that kind of thing. So that was our control group. When you look at these students throughout the entire semester, those who wrote about their deepest, darkest, traumatic events had less visits to the doctor's office. They had less physical symptoms, less colds and flu. Their anxiety and depression scores actually reduced over the course of the semester. That's incredible. 2 to 3 times mm-hmm. for 20 to 30 minutes, and those are the kinds of changes that we're talking about. And the theory behind it is when we have an event that has happened to us that we haven't come to terms with, so often we have these negative thoughts like we were talking about before. I'm blaming myself for what happened. I'm viewing the world as a terrible place. I'm viewing me as a terrible place. All men as terrible. And when we actually write it down and see it, we can get a different perspective. We can see how helpful and how accurate that thinking is. And just by doing that act of journaling, you can completely change your physical and mental health. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and I think one of the inferences from that is, if you want to, you can do a diary, but that's a rather inefficient way of becoming happier, if that's your goal, which is a goal for just about everybody. But if you choose the purpose for why you're journaling and exactly what you're journaling, you're much more likely to get the results you want. And it's okay to experiment with it, too. The current one I'm experimenting with is each morning I try to come up with 10 things that I did the previous day that worked or did some good, because that's what I want to do more of.
That's great. I love that. I love that because you want to do more of it, and it also, it's pat yourself on the back. It's saying, hey, these are some things that I did, and I did well, and that's good. So often, I think, in our society, we're told, don't pat yourself on the back. And obviously, we're not talking about being narcissistic and thinking I'm the best thing in the world. having said that, it is so important to say, what did I do that's right, and how can I learn from it? How can I make it better? As well as how can I feel good about myself? So I applaud you for doing that.
Well, thank you. Well, first of all, it was amazing that you were able to get these all in alphabetical form. Coming up with Y's and Z's and stuff was pretty tricky. What have you been doing since the book came out, or has it mostly been talking with people about the book?
I've been doing a fair amount of media, so radio, TV, print, and speaking, seeing clients. One of the things I'm starting to do now is to go into corporations. American businesses spend over $300 billion because of stress problems, whether it's turnover or reduced productivity or more sick days, more use of insurance because of stress. And a lot of times employees are maybe given, oh, here, look at this and it'll help reduce your stress. But really teaching employees and corporations skills of how to do it in your everyday life without having to take extra time, it's really going to change our entire society, because not only is it going to help us with those financial components that I just talked about, but when we're less stressed and we're more happy, we can interact better. We're more creative and able to solve problems. We can listen to our customers and listen to our coworkers and be able to work together in a better synergy. You know, again, we're less likely to use healthcare costs and insurance when we are happy and have less stress in our lives. So I really see this as a big shift in the way that corporations and businesses are going to handle things. And I think, too, I think the recession has been a big help with that, which may sound ironic, but I think a lot of times with the recession, it helps people see that they can't just go out and spend more money because they don't have it, and to start to look at home and look within themselves. I think the recession's been really helpful with that. I also think that with younger people coming into the workforce, work-life balance is very important to that generation, and I think they're going to be demanding more programs like this in order to stay.
It's quite a shock to a lot of corporations dealing with the Gen Yers. And I suspect that a lot of corporations, if you approach them, you get, oh, that touchy-feely stuff, oh, give me a break. Do you present it to them as stress management, or how do you get around that skepticism about this being soft stuff? We'll get back to Dr. Lombardo in just a moment. But first, I'd like to talk to you for a minute about coaching. Just as success calls for being crystal clear about who you are and what you want, success at life calls for being very clear about who you are, what you want, and how you'll achieve it. Historically, psychologists have focused on fixing what's wrong with you. From almost 40 years of clinical experience, I'm very good at doing that, but what I most enjoy is helping successful people be even more successful and healthier. Just as athletes use coaches to achieve their full potential, coaching by phone can help you achieve your full potential. If you have goals that you're having difficulty achieving or are interested in life makeover coaching to help you develop a comprehensive plan for your life, give me a call and I'll see if I can get you on my coaching schedule. The phone number is on all my websites, and further information about my coaching is at drbrickey.com. That's drbrickey.com. Also on drbrickey.com, you can read about the coaching I did with three women that was featured in 6 issues of Let's Live magazine. And now back to Dr. Lombardo.
I show them the facts, which again are those $300 billion every year. That's crazy. That's a huge amount. And there are some studies out there that are showing a return on investment of people, of companies that are implementing these types of programs, whether it's relaxation and mindfulness, exercise, weight management, smoking cessation, and the return on investment is really, really impressive. And what I do is I address all of those, because in order to lose weight, in order to stop smoking, you have to change what you're saying to yourself. And so these concepts that I talk about in the book of happiness really apply to any change that we want to make in our life.
So we can even have workplaces that decide they want to be happier.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, too, I'm actually going out to Vegas this week to talk to Zappos, which you may or may not be familiar with, but Tony Hsieh is the CEO of Zappos and has taken the company, which sells shoes online, mm-hmm. from a rather small company to just a multi-million dollar company. He has a book coming out in a couple months called Delivering Happiness. And his whole philosophy is the workplace, Zappos, is a very happy place. They teach people how to have more happiness skills. As a matter of fact, they have a library where employees can go and take the books. They buy the books from them, they take the books. My book, I am beyond honored to say, has been, it's all sold out. It's all gone there because people are coming to it, they're taking the book, and they're learning from it. So I think with people like Tony Hsieh, who's going to be really promoting this, delivering happiness and why it's important in the corporations, I think more people are going to be able to see the benefits and believe in the benefits. So it's not just some shrink saying, oh, let's all be happy and hug each other. It's real results.
Well, on top of that, he's got a corporate name that's fun to say.
Yeah, it is.
Can you give me an example of other corporations that have done programs to help their employees be happier and function better?
I don't know of other ones that are actually looking at the happiness per se. I do know there are a lot of companies out there who do lifestyle management, who try to help you with your exercise and your sleep and your alcohol consumption and your smoking. My philosophy is we need to take a step back even further because, again, if someone is drinking a lot, why? Sometimes it's a physiological addiction. Often it's because they're not happy and they're having stress. So if we can teach them how to have less stress and more happiness, if we can give them what I call different tools in their toolbox, so when they're feeling stressed, what they can do, right now when they look in their toolbox, it's a bottle or it's cigarettes. If we have more things for them to do that work for them. So I'm not talking about asking everyone to sit cross-legged and say aum for 3 hours. For some people that works, for some people it doesn't. But finding tools that really, that fit them, that feel good to them, that work for them, then everything's going to change. I mean, the research shows that people, when they're less stressed and happier, they don't eat as much. They don't eat as much junk food, that comfort food. They don't drink as much. They don't smoke. They exercise more. They sleep better. So I think we need to really take a step back and address kind of some of the fundamental stuff. And then those changes that the corporations want to see, like the exercise, like the weight loss, like the smoking cessation, they're going to be a lot easier.
Well, each of those programs, the smoking, the weight loss, the exercise, could be just a kind of a lockstep course that people go through. And that lacks the validation that we were talking about earlier, that I understand you're in a lot of pain, that there are good reasons that you're doing this, and let's look at the reasons. But in each of those areas, the program could just as easily be designed to go through those steps or have each person go through those steps, and it's still doable on a corporate basis.
It's completely doable. And right now what's happening is there's a lot of Band-Aid approaches. So with the weight loss, they're teaching people how to eat. That's an important component. Having said that, a lot of people out there know McDonald's not as good as Fresh Garden Salad. I mean, this is common knowledge. The question is, how do we apply it? There's a popular TV show, The Biggest Loser, out there.
Mm-hmm.
And these people, as you probably know, are losing hundreds of pounds. When you're looking at a lot of the people who go off the show and you look at what happens, so many people are gaining the weight back and feeling horrible about it. Why? Because they didn't change their brain. They changed their behaviors, but they didn't change what was motivating the behavior, so that when they went away from the cameras, when they went away from Jillian yelling at them to exercise more and having the foods that are freshly prepared and good for you, when they went back to their regular lives, they went back to their old thinking habits and their own behaviors. So changing, the first step is changing your understanding, your conceptualization, what you're saying to yourself. Again, that change your brain, get more champagne. And then the other stuff is so much easier. And you're right. We want to ask, what is good about what you're doing right now? So empathizing, when I'm working with people who are smoking and want to quit smoking, for example, one of the first things I ask is, what's good about smoking?
Mm-hmm.
They don't need me to tell them that smoking can cause lung cancer and makes you look old and gives you wrinkles and, you know, causes all kinds of problems. They know that. So I ask them, what's good about it? And usually they are so stunned that they can't answer for a couple minutes because they can't believe I would ask such a question. People who smoke, smoke for a reason. People who overeat, overeat for a reason. And we don't want to judge that. We want to understand it. I call it data. Whenever we do something that we don't want to do, like overeat or smoke or overdrink, ask yourself why. instead of beating yourself up, ask yourself, what caused me to do that? That's data that's going to give us information so that we can help you in the future.
And also makes you feel like you're not so crazy or weak or hopeless.
That is such a great, great point. We have, going back to that cognitive behavioral therapy, we are constantly having automatic thoughts in our minds. We are having thoughts in our minds and beliefs that we don't even realize we're having, and yet we know that we're having them because of what we do. So if I'm trying to lose weight and yet I keep finding myself going to that bag of cookies and eating a whole bag of cookies each and every day, why? I'm saying something to myself, probably like, I'm sad, this is the only thing that's going to make me feel better, or I had a hard day, I deserve this. Whatever I'm saying to myself is propelling that behavior. And because we don't always identify that automatic thought, we do feel helpless, and we do feel hopeless, and we feel worthless. And so absolutely, understanding what we're saying to ourselves is so vital to not only making changes, but to forgiving ourselves and understanding ourselves.
And I think one of the inferences of this, we're a society that wants instant results. We want that antidepressant pill that will cure our depression and get over the feelings of losing an arm or a leg. Then we say, oh, well, I'll go a little deeper. So you get a magazine article, 5 things you need to do to lose weight, or 10 foods you should eat or shouldn't eat. When those aren't working, then it's time to go deeper to look at the psychological aspects of what is smoking doing for me, what is compulsive eating doing for me. If you really want to be happy, the places where you're stuck, you need to go deeper.
Exactly. And understanding that that is a sign of strength, going deeper, especially if you go talk to someone, a therapist, that's a huge sign of strength. So often I hear people say, oh, it took me 4 years to come in to see you. I say, oh, okay. Have you taken your car in lately? In the past 4 years, have you ever taken your car in to get a checkup or a tune-up? Well, yeah, you know, every 10,000 miles. Oh, okay. So you treat your car better than you treat yourself. That's insane when we really take a look at that.
We also treat our pets better than we treat ourselves.
So very true. So very true. So really taking a look at that, and again, it's not about being egocentric or self-centered, because when you are happier, when you are healthier, everything and everyone around you benefits. When you are happier, relationships are better. You're better as a parent, as a spouse, as a worker, as a neighbor, as a friend, as a child. Your physical health is better. You're more productive at work. The benefits are just incredible.
I couldn't agree more.
I know I'm preaching to the choir here, because I so applaud in looking at, obviously not all of the stuff you do, because you do so much, but in looking at what you've been up to, it's really terrific.
The biggest difference between us, besides me not knowing physical therapy, although I started learning that once, is that I put an emphasis on feeling younger, and your emphasis is on feeling happier, but they overlap about 90%.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just to recap, we're saying the best starting place is to start with an assessment of your purpose and values, and that'll help you figure out where to focus.
Yeah, and I think my concern is when people say that, it sounds a little too philosophical, and I'm not that deep, but you know what? You don't have to be. Again, I have a sheet on my website. It's a list of values, and what I recommend people do is circle or just indicate, what are my top 5 values? That's all you have to do. Mm-hmm. And then when you figure out what they are, start applying them into your life. Another thing, another great starting point of what we talked about before is that gratitude. Every single day, write down 3 things that you feel grateful for, that you appreciate. They don't have to be big things. They don't have to be $1 million. It could be, I'm in Pittsburgh and it's not very sunny here. So today it's sunny and I'm thinking, yay, that's going to be one of the things that I'm appreciating. It could be someone holding the door for you, someone smiling at you, an email that a friend sent you. It doesn't have to be big, but starting to appreciate those little things.
And
those are really the secrets to happiness. Happy people, we said before, it's not that they don't experience unpleasant emotion. Happy people also have problems. They have challenges just like the rest of the world. They see those challenges, they appreciate the learning experiences, they accept the negative, and they move on from them.
So instead of saying, well, I'll get out of bed just as soon as the snooze alarm goes off 3 more times, you can say, I'll get out of bed as soon as I tell myself 3 things that I'm grateful for. It makes a big difference in how you start the day.
It totally totally does. And imagine getting out of bed that way. Instead of, oh, I've got to do this and this and this, and I didn't do this. Imagine getting out of bed feeling grateful and having that positive energy inside of you. It's going to change everything.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Lombardo, author of A Happy You, Your Ultimate Prescription for Happiness. She's a psychologist, physical therapist, and practices in the Pittsburgh area, as well as doing professional speaking. And the website, again, is ahappyyou, spelled YOU.com. Dr. Lombardo, I really appreciate you sharing with us. Excellent book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being on this radio show. And I so applaud what you're doing, because you're just doing some really great work.
Thank you. Commentary. Dr. Lombardo's emphasis is on treating happiness as a skill that we can learn and hone. Her approach is primarily cognitive behavioral, that is, emphasizing what we think and what we do. She points out that 75% of visits to doctors involve no diagnosable condition. She approaches people with pain by acknowledging that their pain is real, then looking for the stress behind it, and also finding ways to lower the stress and redirect the attention to something else. And you don't have to be a psychologist to use that approach. We talked about forgiving as one of the trickiest skills to acquire. Forgiveness isn't about condoning what happened or forgetting what happened. Rather, it's about releasing yourself from the anger and the stress that goes with holding on to resentments. Thus, the person who forgives is the one who is freed and is the one who becomes the beneficiary. We discussed three kinds of journaling: journaling positive events or gratitude, tracking goals, and third, addressing specific negative event with the idea of helping to resolve the angst and the aftermath. Journaling with a clear purpose in mind is much more efficient than just keeping a diary. Now, if you read Dr. Lombardo's book cover to cover, it would be easy to say that, oh, these are all good ideas, but hey, I'm overwhelmed by all these approaches, and end up doing nothing. The solution is to start with assessing your values and let your values assessment lead you to what to emphasize in being happier. I also note that if you are trying to solve complex behaviors like weight loss and not succeeding, the solution probably isn't a magic pill or a magazine article with 10 tips, but drilling down to better determine what the dynamics of the problem are and what tweaks are most likely to help. You are listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For further information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and my keynote and seminar services, just go to notaging.com or drbricky.com, drbricky.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.